Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Upwork has the world's largest network of independent professionals. Let me just close this real quick. So if you need a back-end developer, a UI designer, or a project manager for 6 days or 6 months, Upwork is how.
Hey, I have this room booked at noon.
I'm just wrapping up here. Upwork professionals have the flexibility and capability to work from anywhere.
Yeah, it's 1201.
Okay, it's all yours. Which is nice if you're already low on conference rooms. Plus, they're proven, rated, and reviewed. When you need in-demand talent on demand, Upwork is how.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
I can't believe this. They're not going to land.
Episode 1, available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 14th of March. Our main stories: President Trump declares a national emergency in response to the coronavirus outbreak in the US. And the head of the World Health Organization says Europe has become the epicenter of the global pandemic. Also in the podcast, Italy arrests one of its most wanted mafia bosses. And
TikTok's going to be the platform that within the next 12 months, brands are going to be looking at very carefully, and they're going to be putting marketing budget into those influencers.
Is TikTok the next big thing for business? 2 weeks ago, the US President Donald Trump dismissed the threat from coronavirus as a Democrat hoax. Recently, he's made controversial comments about people going to work with the virus and getting better. And he said he didn't want to see the official infection figures going up. But in the past few days, his attitude seems to have changed, with a ban on travel from much of Europe and now a declaration of national emergency across the United States. He said the move would free up $50 billion in emergency funding and allow the federal government to coordinate state and local governments. Mr. Trump also said an extra 500,000 tests would be available next week and 5 million within a month.
10 days ago, I brought together the CEOs of commercial labs at the White House and directed them to immediately begin working on a solution to dramatically increase the availability of tests. As a result of that action, today we're announcing a new partnership with private sector to vastly increase and accelerate our capacity to test for the coronavirus.
The president also said it was likely he would be tested for the virus fairly soon. So was this all about giving more funding to the authorities? Julian Marshall spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Platt-Usher.
That is a really big part of it. He said up to $50 billion for state and local governments to respond to the outbreak. So that is the kind of thing that presidents do when they have a natural or a natural disaster. So they're treating the epidemic as in the same way, and that can be used for treatment, for testing, for building infrastructure, all sorts of things. But the other thing he said, which is to give the Secretary of Health and Human Services emergency authorities to waive federal laws and regulations, is also quite important, because it gives doctors and hospitals at the state level the kind of flexibility they need to improvise, basically. They have been hampered by tight federal regulations, for example, in terms of getting tests sorted out. That is one of the reasons that the testing was so delayed. So basically, he's saying, the president, that the doctors and the hospitals at a local level will be able to decide what's the best way to approach a situation. And that could actually make quite a big difference.
But a number of states have already declared, have they not, states of emergency, Barbara?
They have. 22 states at least have declared various levels of states of emergency, which allows them to do things like restrict travel, impose curfews, sort of restrict public gatherings, that kind of social distancing sort of measures to be taken. I think what the health and the health secretary will be able to do is talk about sort of official stuff with relates to medical regulations, which is something that states can't do on their own.
Does President Trump now give the impression of somebody who's listening to the scientific advice?
Well, I suppose yes and no. Yes, in the sense that he is talking about steps to take that will address the worst part of the epidemic. But at the same time, he does keep throwing in statements that make you feel he's not taking it that seriously himself. So, for example, he's constantly asked why he hasn't been tested, especially since he had exposure to the virus last week when a Brazilian delegation was visiting. And he once again repeated that he had no symptoms whatsoever, so presumably will not be tested. So he also continually says this will pass. This will pass, which it will, of course. But he does sometimes come across as kind of emphasizing that at the expense of talking about how serious it is.
His point man on the coronavirus, Mike Pence, the vice president, standing beside him. And he later spoke about the virus being present in, what, 46 states?
Yeah, 46. I had actually counted 47 earlier in the day because those figures have been updated throughout the day. We started out with something like 1,700 cases. And when I last checked, it was now 1,800 cases. So, yeah, it is spreading. 46, 47 states, 1,800 cases, 42 deaths announced so far. Some places obviously much more affected than others. But having come to the capital here in D.C. in recent days, there has been quite immediate reaction. I think they'd reached a critical moment anyway when there was action across the country in terms of shutting things down. But now the White House, Congress, the Capitol Hill buildings, Supreme Court have all closed to any sort of visitors. And it's really taking effect here as well.
Barbara Plett-Usher reacting to President Trump's speech in Washington. Meanwhile, Canada is suspending parliamentary sittings and delaying the budget to try to slow the spread of the coronavirus there. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who is in self-isolation after his wife tested positive for the virus, urged people to follow medical advice.
I want to be clear. I have no symptoms and I'm feeling good. Of course, it's an inconvenience and somewhat frustrating, but we have to do this. Because we have to protect our neighbors and our friends, especially our more vulnerable seniors and people with pre-existing conditions.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Well, in his news conference, President Trump said Americans returning to the US from European destinations would face strict quarantine measures. Europe as a continent is now the epicenter of the global pandemic, according to the World Health Organization, with more cases being reported there every day than in China at the height of its epidemic. The WHO boss, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, urged governments to step up their responses.
Not testing alone, not contact tracing alone, not quarantine alone, not social distancing alone, do it all. Any country that looks at the experience of other countries with large epidemics and thinks that won't happen to us is making a deadly mistake.
At least 10 countries across Europe are now enforcing border closures, with most banning entry to foreigners. In the continent's worst affected nation, Italy, 250 people died in a single day, the highest total yet. But there is also some more hopeful news from there, as Seema Kotecha reports from Rome.
For the first time since the outbreak began, the figures suggest the rate of the increase has slowed down, with fewer people infected over the last day than in previous days. The government says stringent measures in place restricting free movement across the country is helping to keep it at bay. But another large daily increase might not convince some citizens their plan is working.
Spain is also badly affected, with a 50% increase in the number of fatalities, prompting the authorities to declare a state of emergency. The details from Damian Grammaticus in Madrid.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez addressed the nation on national television. He announced that the state of emergency would come into force from Saturday. And what it does is it gives him the power to control the movement of people, to control areas, to requisition resources in order to direct the public health emergency, he said. Now, he said Spain was facing difficult weeks ahead. He said the number of infected people could rise to 10,000 next week.
And that was Damian Grammaticus in Madrid. Panic buying as a result of the outbreak has led to some profiteering. But security experts say they have seen a spike in email scams linked to the virus. Industries and individuals have been targeted with phishing emails written in multiple languages. Our cybersecurity reporter Joe Tidy told me what to watch out for.
They're very sophisticated and they are very clever. And what they're doing is they are preying on the fear around coronavirus. It's on everyone's minds around the world. Everyone's searching for answers and guidance. And the hackers know this. And they know that if they can use their phishing emails to get your interest with these sorts of messages and these sorts of subject lines in the email, they know that you were more likely to click on those. So what we're seeing is a number of different techniques. They are using emails from, they look like they're from the World Health Organization, but of course they're not. And in those emails, there is click here for advice. And there's also ones about tax rebates. The coronavirus is affecting the economy. Here's some money, but we just need your bank details first.
And how can you tell that these are scams, these emails?
It's very, very hard to tell. This is the problem. They look so good. The hackers over the years have developed very, very sophisticated ways. And in some ways, they're not sophisticated. All they're doing effectively is looking at the types of email signatures that you would see on a WHO email, the types of web addresses that are connected to the World Health Organization or others. And they are effectively spoofing those. So in some cases, they are making the emails look very similar to a legitimate email, or they're even spoofing the actual email. So you could get an email that actually is from a legitimate WHO email, and you think, oh, that's trustworthy, but actually they've just spoofed the email. So it's very, very, very hard to know what's real and what's not. But there is some advice out there. So for example, if there is a link inside an email that says click here, and you think, oh, that looks quite good, that might help me, before you click, just hover your mouse cursor over that link, and it will tell you exactly where that link is taking you to.
And what kind of attacks are we seeing being carried out by these cyber criminals?
Well, there's a number of different things. The most common is sort of classic phishing technique, whereby you encourage someone to click on your link, which takes you to a fake website and encourages you to put in your username and password or even your bank details. And you think you're giving those to legitimate places, but actually, in fact, you're giving them to hackers. But there's also some really serious stuff we're seeing as well. For example, one of the emails that was spotted by a cybersecurity company called Proofpoint was an email that said, here, click on this document and it will give you the very, very latest advice from the World Health Organization. If you download that document, you're not downloading advice, you're actually downloading a malicious piece of software called Agent Logger, which logs every single keystroke that you make on the computer. So effectively, whatever you do on your computer, the hackers can see that. And there's also another one called a RAT, a remote access Trojan. Again, you accidentally download it and it gives hackers complete control of your computer.
Our cyber security reporter, Joe Tidy. The coronavirus is already having a big impact on businesses, with some employees asked to work from home to minimise the risk of infecting fellow staff. To find out how easy that is, let's hear from my colleague Nuala McGovern, who this week broadcast her programme from her apartment.
Today, my studio is a little bit smaller. A bit echoey as well, I know. I'm in my kitchen as I carry out a contingency plan to make sure I could talk to you and bring you OS if, in fact, I had to self-isolate for some period in case of the coronavirus. So what am I doing? I'm on a big pink armchair, balancing my laptop on a high kitchen stool with my husband as a reluctant producer.
Nuala McGovern, working from home in London. In the Netherlands, the Dutch bank ABN AMRO ordered many of its 14,000 employees to start working from home as a precautionary measure. Dias Donker, head of investor relations for the bank, is based in Amsterdam, and she spoke to Julian Marshall.
We are working in a split team, and then it's 1 week in the office and 1 week working from home, and then we take turns. And the idea behind it is that if somehow somebody falls ill, we don't have to send away an entire team.
So you've got all the technology in place, but how easy is it to make decisions, seek input from others if you're not face-to-face physically?
What I have done with my team is make sure that we have a daily call in the morning so everybody can air their thoughts, maybe frustrations from working at home. But we also have a lot of technological solutions so we can jointly work in presentations. We can have video conferences through that system. And of course, we can have team calls.
It seems to me that there are not as many pointless meetings as a result of this.
Maybe that's a beneficial side effect, yes.
Do some of your workers prefer this way of working?
Well, I think it enhances efficiency. I mean, there's fewer conversations at the coffee machine. Maybe certain meetings may drag on a bit. And the good thing, you know, as a team, we've got quite some experience already, because I would say every team member is already working from home 1 day a week.
The other side of the coin is, though, that some might find it quite difficult? Maybe they're not as tech savvy as others?
Well, we've got one expert in the team that certainly helps, so he can help all of us. And so we're actually keeping abreast of all the possibilities there are in order to tackle and solve technical issues.
For any managers listening to this interview, what advice would you have for them to prevent people from abusing the privilege, perhaps, of working from home, maybe nipping out to see a movie, for instance?
Well, my boss has made sure that we've got a daily call fairly early in the morning, so we all get out of bed. I mean, that could be one way, but I'll leave it up to my team's responsibility and give trust to them that they do the things that they need to do.
I mean, even if the coronavirus goes away and companies return to normal, do you think that you or your company could see working from home in the way that you have described as a permanent arrangement?
Maybe not 5 days a week, but like I said, quite a few of our colleagues, including ourselves, do this already for like 1 day a week. And that I would expect to continue. And maybe colleagues who don't do this at this point in time see the benefit. It gives people flexibility.
Dees Donker from the Dutch bank ABN AMRO talking to Julian Marshall. And still to come, one unexpected consequence coronavirus quarantine measures have had in China.
It's now become a trend that with people getting back to work, people being able to leave their apartments and their houses, that a number of couples are rushing to get divorced.
Yes, we'll return to the coronavirus later in the podcast, but now for some other news. And the Zimbabwean government says it will offer land instead of money to compensate the owners of nearly 800 farms, which were taken during its controversial land seizure program. The farm takeovers triggered an economic collapse from which Zimbabwe is still struggling to recover. Shingo Nyoka reports from the capital, Harare.
Over 5,000 farms were seized, hundreds of them protected by bilateral agreements. By law, Zimbabwe was obligated to pay compensation, but decades on, only a fraction has been paid out. The new regulations to offer land rather than cash is seen as a move to resolve a long-running dispute that has isolated Zimbabwe. Paying compensation is one of the central conditions to restoring full diplomatic ties with Western nations and ending U.S. sanctions. The government has said it will only pay for improvements and not the land itself.
Chingai Nyoka in Harare. Italian police say they've arrested one of the most wanted bosses of the 'Ndrangheta Mafia in the southern province of Calabria. Danny Eberhard has the details.
It's hard to find many glimmers of positivity amid the massive disruption of the coronavirus outbreak in Italy. But Italian police have found one in the arrest of Cesare Cordi. A faint glow of a cigarette, seen through the slits of shutters, was enough to confirm that the fugitive was inside a hideaway that seemed deserted. They've been hunting him for days. He'd been on the run, having escaped a major operation against his clan in August. The police said the emergency restrictions brought in to combat the coronavirus helped. It severely limited the movements of other citizens, who tend to pop out only for food.
Danny Eberhard. For late adopters of social media, people like me, TikTok is a Chinese-owned social media platform that lets you share short video clips. It was the second most downloaded app last year after WhatsApp and now has more than a billion users. Many are teenagers, and one of the attractions is you don't necessarily have to be a celebrity to make videos which get millions of views. On other platforms like Instagram and YouTube, social media stars can make lots of money. So is money important for TikTok's rising stars? Dougal Shaw reports.
Yo, what's up, TikTok? I've just bought loads of popcorn, and I'm going to be pranking my brother by putting it all in his bed sheets.
You're listening to a video by Jake, a 21-year-old student from Cambridgeshire who is a TikTok star. He makes about 20 videos a week for the social media platform. This popcorn prank got more than 880,000 views.
Originally, I didn't start to become a social media influencer. I got on there just to have some fun with a few friends.
And how quickly did things take off? Because now your videos can get, you know, like 500,000 views.
To be honest, they took off immediately. They started doing amazing. I see the potential in it straight away.
In just over a year, Jake has picked up 3 million followers, putting him very much at pop star level. And this is the appeal. Anyone in theory can become TikTok famous.
Ah! Oh my gosh. Exploding pen prank
on my boyfriend.
The Chinese-owned app now has more than 40 million daily active users, including a global army of teenagers. It stands out from Instagram or Facebook because of the way it finds videos for you to watch. Instead of basing your feed on your friend's activity, it monitors closely your own behaviour on the app to figure out your hidden tastes. The result is an addictive, never-ending stream of short videos on your phone, most set to music.
You know what I'm waiting for.
And that's not the only thing that's different about the app.
The trends which dominate TikTok and really determine what is popular on TikTok change so quickly.
That's Sarah McCorkadale. She runs an influencer intelligence agency, keeping an eye on the latest social media developments. The trends she's talking about are challenges set by TikTok that make the platform feel like an open talent competition.
TikTok is going to be the platform that within the next 12 months, brands are going to be looking at very carefully, and they're going to be putting marketing budget into those influencers.
With his 3 million followers, Jake is an influencer.
I do get money from TikTok. It does help me out a lot with university or even spending my videos. Like, a lot of my videos do cost a lot of money.
How do you actually get the money? Who gives it to you?
So I get money through promotions, and it's all through my management agency, Fanbytes.
Fanbytes offices are in a trendy loft in East London. This is where I met its founder, Timothy Armu.
Right now, TikTok has become the place for a lot of teens to spend their time on.
Armu thinks if you have around 2 million followers on TikTok, you can earn a steady annual income of about £20,000, and that figure will rise. But that assumes TikTok itself will continue to grow. As its popularity has increased, so too has criticism for its handling of issues like user privacy, health and safety, and child protection. And as far as influencer activity is concerned, the Advertising Standards Authority is taking a more active role policing all platforms. TikTok say they are taking measures to ensure influencers stick to the rules.
I don't think there's any way I'll ever get off TikTok.
Your career could be social media influencer.
It definitely could, yeah.
Dougal Shaw reporting. Let's return now to the coronavirus pandemic and the US declaration of a national emergency, allowing the federal government to tap up to $50 billion in emergency funding, comes as some of the world's biggest sports events are put on hold and more businesses warn about possible job cuts. Germany has announced emergency measures to help shore up struggling firms there with an offer of $500 billion worth of support. China is also trying to get its economy back on track, but many factories and offices there remain closed. So are we heading for a global recession, as some fear? I spoke to our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
We are certainly heading for a substantially weaker year of economic growth than we had in 2019. Whether that actually turns into a global recession, well, it obviously partly depends on how you define a global recession. There's a lot more vagueness, frankly, about international definitions. But one is that it's perhaps less than 2.5% economic growth. On that basis, it's entirely possible. Another definition is that it's a decline in economic activity per person across the world, and when you've got population growing at about 1.1%, that means a global recession on that basis would be economic growth of less than 1.1%. That would take more damage than we are currently looking at. So much will turn, frankly, on how quickly the world can get on top of this health crisis. If it drags on, then the economic damage will correspondingly drag on for a long period and will do real damage.
Yeah, because if you look at the figures, at least in China, things seem to be stabilising there, and that is the world's second biggest economy. But I guess there's still a lot more they have to get back on track before life returns to normal.
There are these questions about getting life back to normal and whether, partly with Chinese people moving around more, with perhaps more visitors coming in from outside, whether you might see another wave of the health problem. So huge amounts of uncertainty. And we have had from China in the last week or so some economic surveys, which were, frankly, terrible. These are surveys of business confidence, what their order books look like and so forth. And those were pointing to a quite possibly a recession in China. If things go badly wrong in China, that drags down global figures, but it also has consequences in terms of business opportunities for countries that trade with China, which is most of them.
And if growth does suffer, what does that mean for ordinary people?
It would mean for most people some sort of combination of lower living standards, incomes that are lower than they were. Some people will lose jobs. Some people will maintain their day-to-day lifestyle by drawing down on savings. Some people running small businesses will have a very difficult time. I mean, if we do have a serious global recession, then there will be small businesses that don't make it. There'll be some large businesses that don't make it. What is really important, though, is that governments and central banks around the world are acutely aware of that issue, and so much of the response that we've had in terms of policy has been about measures to try and ensure that businesses aren't finished off by a short-term cash flow problem. They do not want permanent damage done when businesses might actually be fundamentally viable and capable of getting back to normal if they can get through what hopefully is a short-term crisis.
Our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. We end the podcast in mainland China, where the virus first emerged at the end of December. On Friday, the Chinese authorities said they had recorded only 8 new cases, suggesting the outbreak there is coming under control. But as some restrictions are lifted, there have been some unexpected consequences from the lengthy quarantine period, as I've been hearing from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
Well, in one Chinese city in the southwest, a place called Dazhou in Sichuan province, it's now become a trend that with people getting back to work, people being able to leave their apartments and their houses, that a number of couples are rushing to get divorced. They've been in self-quarantine for a long period of time, only really going out to buy essentials. And there's been a notable spike in divorce rates in this city, largely local media say because people have been spending much more time with each other, which means they've been having many more arguments. In China, it's very easy to get divorced very, very quickly as well. In fact, there was a case I saw last year where one man was able to get divorced 23 times within a year. One of the things we have to consider is that this, as a nation, has brought China together. It's been everybody united in fighting this virus, so they've seen, being in self-quarantine. So there has been a lot of positivity in the media and everybody feeling that they're helping the government in order to fight the virus, but at the same time, at a very small level, obviously there have been fights between people who share a house.
And the government isn't happy when people get divorced, is it?
It's not, no. And actually, before this whole coronavirus started, there was a major push in China for increased marriage rates, increased birth rates as well. So couples were really being encouraged to have more children and, get married as soon as possible, because there has been a problem in China with a result of the one-child policy, that there are fewer children nowadays who are able to find partners, and the labour market is shrinking because a lot of elderly people are retiring. So the government wants, it doesn't want a situation where the population falls off a cliff. It wants to keep the momentum of previous years.
Now, we talked about the difficulties of being stuck at home together. Are the authorities now going to lift all the quarantine restrictions as a result of the huge decline in cases?
No, they're still being very cautious about this. I mean, they're conscious that different governments around the world are tackling this in different ways, and they're looking at ways that they can make sure that China doesn't see huge spikes again. But at the same time, there are some areas of China now where children are going back to school for the first time, and a number of businesses are starting to resume operations as well. So it does feel for some people that there is a sense of normality coming back into place.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Suddenly there was a big bang.
An explosion in the depths of space.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
Three astronauts in grave danger.
It looks grim. Yes, it does.
As space exploration becomes a life or death situation.
We're not going to the moon anymore. We're going to just be damn lucky to get home.
13 Minutes to the Moon returns with a story of a dramatic rescue mission.
You're 200,000 miles out. You're in a spacecraft that's dying.
The real story of Apollo 13.
I literally got on my knees and prayed.
13 Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
We don't have much time.
From the BBC World Service.
There's one whole side of that spacecraft missing.
Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the end right there.
Thank you.
great podcasts deserve a great platform. That's why Pocket Cast delivers a beautifully designed, simple, but powerful experience that offers more control. It's the premium app for podcast listening, search, and discovery. And it's now free. Download Pocket Cast today at pocketcast.com or find us in the Apple app or Google Play stores.